This afternoon we begin Disability Rights and Immigrants. We have three people to present on this platform or on this particular item. The Litigation Counsel for Disability Rights California, Aaron Fisher. And the Pro Bono Coordinator of El Otro Lado. How did I do?
Great.
Catherine Gordon and Mark Weber, who is the Vincent DePaul Professor of Law at DePaul University College of Law. The subject of immigration is in the news always, especially recently. The subject of disability is rarely. However, there is a significant interaction, and it is an important matter for us to discuss. We begin with Aaron Fisher. There you go.
All right, good afternoon. Thank you so much for having me. I've heard from a number of people already today that immigration is sort of pervading this conference. I think that's great. And I want to start by explaining why I think that is the case. And it's not just because it's in the news so much. I think it's extremely relevant to the work that we all do and the goals that we all have. So why? Why does it matter? Why should we be talking about it? So the first is obvious. More and more people with a range of disabilities are getting entangled in the increasing challenges of our immigration system. That's because the number of people coming into the country is going up, number of people seeking asylum is going up. It's also we see more and more people being detained. We see more and more people getting caught up with the barriers to gaining asylum, to remaining in the country. Mark will talk a little bit about the public charge regulation that may be coming down the pike. And these are issues that sort of distinctly impact people with disabilities. And I'll talk about that a little bit. But it's not just that there are people in any population that are gonna have a range of disabilities, and immigrants are no exception. I think there's actually been an increasing targeting of people with disabilities in the immigration system. The public charge issue that Mark's gonna talk about, top of the list, but that's not the only one. In 2009, DHS did its own studies and came up with a report with recommendations that said, we can do better with our system. And one of the ways to do that is to exercise prosecutorial discretion in who gets detained. Right now, more than 40,000 people on any given day are in ICE detention, more are in Customs and Border Patrol, and many, many youth are in a separate system of detention. But in 2009, there was a push to try and rethink that and to exercise prosecutorial discretion. So, and by 2011, and then further clarified in 2014, there were directives from DHS, Department of Homeland Security, saying that there needs to really be a compelling reason for people with physical and psychiatric disabilities and other sorts of special needs, people who are pregnant or nursing, have family members with special needs, to keep this group in detention while their immigration proceedings are going on. In January 2017, probably won't surprise too many people here, that guidance was withdrawn. No more prosecutorial discretion. And what we've seen is an increasing number of people with disabilities ending up in detention for weeks, months, and even years. So that's sort of the backdrop. And I'll just give a personal anecdote about how our organization got involved with this issue, the rights and well-being of immigrants with disabilities. In 2017, California, the state legislature, passed a few laws trying to protect the rights of immigrants in the state of California. And one of the directives from the state legislature was for the California Attorney General to go into immigration detention facilities up and down the state and to report back on a number of aspects: conditions, circumstances of arrest and transfer, access to counsel, those types of things. The Attorney General convened a number of sessions up and down the state of California and invited advocates, people who they thought could be helpful as they sort of worked out what this investigation and report was going to look like. I went to one of those meetings. Some of my colleagues went to one of those meetings. We were invited because we were doing an investigation at Sacramento County Jail, which at the time had about 100 immigration detainees at that facility. So they invited me to come. Sitting in the room, there were about 40 of us, immigration advocates, ACLU, all types of great organizations. And at some point, I realized I was the only person in the room that came from a disability rights perspective and background. Coming out of that meeting, I was convinced that the Attorney General's staff was going to do an excellent job with their report, and there was no way that disability was going to get the attention that it needed. So our organization, Disability Rights California, tried to complement what they were doing, and we've opened up a number of monitoring investigations. So a quick word about Disability Rights California. Most people know how the protection advocacy systems work, but for those who don't, we have a special statutory authority that allows us to go into facilities that house, treat, and serve people with disabilities. That includes hospitals, psychiatric facilities, jails, juvenile facilities, and why can't it include immigration detention as well, we said. So since that time, in the last 2 years, we've opened up a number of monitoring investigations, which allows us to get into these facilities. We can monitor, when we're in the facility, we can bring experts with us, and we do. We can take photos, and we do. We can talk to people in the facility, we can talk to staff. We have a pretty wide range of tools to try and figure out what is going on and how people with disabilities are being treated and what the experience is like. We can issue public reports, we can litigate, we can partner with other organizations. We have a number of tools in our tool belts. Being able to go into these facilities, just by way of an example, some of the about a year ago when the separated youth issue was sort of hot, very hard for Congress people to get into facilities that were housing the immigration youth that had been separated from their families at the border. Our organization was the first to have people get access into some of those facilities and monitor conditions there. So it's a pretty strong tool. We've been inside in California of the largest privately operated immigration detention facility in the state, and I think in the country. It's Adelanto Detention Center in San Bernardino in Southern California. Has about 1,900 detainees on a given day. Once we were in there, we found that at least a third had some sort of mental health needs, in some cases very serious mental health needs, and many more had a range of other disabilities: mobility, vision, hearing, really across the board, like any cross-section that you'd see in our communities. We went to Orange County Jail, the largest county jail-based operated facility in the state of California, housing ICE detainees, housing about 700 to 800 ICE detainees on a given day. We went to Yolo County Juvenile Detention Facility, which is a juvenile detention facility where immigrant youth are side-by-side with county juveniles that are in that system. And as I said, we went to a number of the private facilities that house separated children or unaccompanied minors who've come into the Office of Resettlement, Refugee and Resettlement, sort of another companion to ICE, I'd say. So let me talk about some of our findings. About a month ago, we came out with a report about Adelanto Detention Facility and the experience of people with disabilities there. I brought a handful of copies. If you'd like a copy, you're welcome to take them. We have them in Spanish and English. On our website, we have fully accessible versions, both in Spanish and in English. And I encourage people to take them off the table, look it up online, or talk to me if you'd like to get a copy. Let me go through a couple of our key findings from our monitoring at Adelanto. So first, Adelanto, it's a privately operated facility by Geo Group, one of the major private prison companies in the United States. It is located in what was built as a prison many years ago and was operated as a prison many years ago. And if you walk in, it looks like a prison today. The way the system runs really feels like you're in a jail or a prison. People are in color uniforms, restrictions on property, on the books that they can order and have, restrictions on when they can go outside, when they can eat, when they can shower. It feels like a prison. I don't need to tell you, but for people coming to this country for the first time, asylum seekers, we've already heard about earlier, people who bring a variety of mental health needs with them and histories of trauma, this is a shocking, shocking experience for them to think that they are coming to the United States for safety, to escape persecution and hardship, and to face this. We heard from not a few people that in some ways this was worse than the violence and fear that they were trying to escape. We also looked at the mental health care system and the medical system at Adelanto, and we found it to be generally inadequate. They did not have treatment services. They did not have treatment programming. They had very limited mental health staff. And maybe most disturbingly, we found that when people have a psychiatric disability that gets worse or deteriorates when they're in detention, it's met with a custodial response, a punitive response. And I'll give you just one example. On one of the days that we were on site, my colleague Richard and I, and Pilar, who are here, we're walking around the facility and we heard something going on just in the unit right next to us. And several custody officers, no mental health staff, several custody officers sort of ran to the scene. We finally figured out we saw handcuffs actually flying over a partition. What's happening? We found out that a man who'd been in custody for some time had been on suicide watch, and they were discharging him from suicide watch. Suicide watch is in a stripped-down cell, very harsh place to be. All your clothes are taken away while you're on suicide watch. He was being discharged from suicide watch. As he was being discharged, he was continuing to have difficulty and was acting out and sort of wriggled free from some of the staff and started walking or moving quickly down the hallway. Instead of bringing in a clinician and trying to work with that individual, they immediately took him to a disciplinary solitary confinement unit and put him into a cell there, where things got worse, where he started banging his head against the wall and engaged in some other self-harming behaviors. This went on for some period of time until finally a clinician that we were talking to said, we're actually going to send him out to a hospital to get some treatment and to try and stabilize him. So instead, you certainly have people with vulnerabilities, people get worse, and instead of being met with treatment, they're being met with a custodial and I think what we would say a punitive response. We also found, with respect to people with physical disabilities, other types of disabilities, all sorts of problems with accommodations. I came from working in the state prison system on a case with Rosenbein, Galvin, and Grunfeld that where people with disabilities, though things were not great by any means, there was a system in place through litigation to track and accommodate people with disabilities and to make sure that they're housed appropriately. As far as we could tell, that didn't exist at Adelanto. There is no electronic system to track people. There is no system to make sure that everybody who needs to know when someone needs a sign language interpreter will get a sign language interpreter. We encountered people who did not, who needed sign language interpretation and did not for medical, mental health appointments or anything else. We found people not getting accommodations, people, one man who required a walking cane, not getting it for several months at the facility, broken wheelchairs, and a grievance system that essentially wasn't functional. I'll give you one sort of fun anecdote there. There's a requirement that ICE be notified every time somebody is denied a reasonable accommodation. That is a requirement through the ICE regulations and standards. We asked the coordinator who would receive those notifications, how many in the last, you know, how many times has this happened? How often do you have to deal with these types of situations? He said, well, Adelanto has never denied an accommodation. And he said, so how do you know? He said, well, no one's ever told me that they've denied an accommodation. So we had records that showed grievances, requests for accommodations that had gone unanswered or explicitly been denied, and we showed him, and he kind of looked surprised. A disability accommodation system that's ad hoc and basically non-functional. This is a particular problem in a system like ICE, I think, where people are moving from facilities, moving from one agency to another. So if they're lucky enough to get an accommodation at one point, it's not going to carry over when they get transferred to another facility. And that can have problems all the way down the road. A last and I think really critical finding that we had is that there's a lack of oversight and accountability. I gave you one example where ICE is not aware of when people with disabilities are not getting accommodations that they request or need. Another example that we found is that GEO Group, who operates the facility, is not reporting suicide attempts to ICE, which is a requirement under their contract and the standards. It's an important thing to report, and it's an important thing to report to a government entity because that is a tip of the iceberg of a problematic system, an inadequate system of mental health care, an unmet need. It's not the whole story, but it's an important piece. And we asked them how many suicide attempts had occurred at the facility in 2018, and they came back with a zero. And we said, well, you know, we've spoken with people, we've gone in with experts, we've requested records from people in the facility where the clinicians had documented that somebody had attempted to commit suicide. And we'll show them to you, and what's going on here? And so ICE looked at it, and they said, well, we need to get back to you. And they did get back to us, and they said, well, GEO Group is using a different definition that I guess they haven't trained the clinicians on. And they were using an extremely narrow definition of suicide attempt that essentially allows them not to report anything. And in this case, for 2018, they hadn't reported anything. So there's an oversight issue that obviously poses problems for advocates to try and get underneath and figure out what's going on if there's bad data and lack of oversight and the information is in the hands of a private group. So it gives you a little bit of an overview of our findings. We're sort of figuring out what's going to happen next. I want to turn just for a few minutes and talk about sort of another option, which is litigation, and to do some systems work to try and improve conditions in these facilities. So the first is to think about who do we sue? Certainly ICE, under the regulations and just logic, maintains responsibility for folks in ICE custody and immigration detention, even if the facility is operated by a contracted entity. As I said, some of the facilities are a county municipal contract, like Orange County Jail, which we toured and monitored. And some are these private facilities. About 70% actually are the private facilities, last data I've seen. Even with the private facilities, generally, there will be a local municipality that is also on the contract with ICE. And essentially, the reason they do that is to avoid the bidding process, which is a long federal bidding process. If the contract is with a public entity, you can skip over that process. Carries its own problems, but it also creates an opportunity to go to a municipality and say, you're responsible for this as well. One question that some of you may be asking is, so these are prison-like facilities. Does the Prison Litigation Reform Act apply? And if so, I don't want any part of this type of litigation. This is one of the bright spots. The answer is almost definitely not. The law is pretty clear that detainees, civil detainees, are not prisoners under the Prison Litigation Reform Act. That means that the very burdensome exhaustion requirements likely do not apply, and it means that the very strict fee caps, if you're successful, likely do not apply. So that part is good. Another good part for people who want to do some work in this area is that there are actually a lot of good government documents out there that we can use. I'll give you some examples. In 2011 and again 2016, ICE created national detention standards that are written into the contracts that they have with detention providers. And those standards actually are pretty good. The person, whoever wrote those, I think may have come to a conference like this. They're written well. They may not be worth more than the paper they're written on, but they're good standards that people are supposed to be following. Another is, there is a Office of Inspector General within the Department of Homeland Security that seems to be continuing to do their work. So there are reports trickling out all the time about problems with the use of solitary confinement in these ICE detention facilities, with the inadequate treatment of people with mental illness and other disabilities, and a whole range of other issues. These are government OIG findings that we can use. In California, we're very lucky that we have the California Attorney General that just came out with their first report that I referenced earlier. They came out with that report at the end of February this year, with more findings of potential problems with solitary confinement, inadequate treatment for people with psychiatric disabilities, mental health needs, medical needs. Really good tools for us as advocates. So last area, I just want to talk about some of the key issues and challenges to this sort of litigation. Key issues, I sort of mentioned them, disability discrimination using the ADA and Section 504, and using the 14th Amendment as civil detainees entitled to a standard of treatment. There's been some recent developments on detention conditions and standards in Ninth Circuit and elsewhere. This goes back to Youngberg, the rights of civil detainees held in that case in psychiatric facilities. And I think we've even moved in the right direction on this issue. And I also strongly believe that it's a good opportunity for different advocacy groups to work together. A lot of the work on civil detention that our organization has historically done is people held through involuntary commitments, in psychiatric hospitals and elsewhere to try and do the work of deinstitutionalization and improving conditions. Well, a civil detainee held in a psychiatric hospital has the same legal status as a civil detainee held in immigration proceedings, at least according to the 14th Amendment. So it's a real opportunity for us to put our heads together on this front. And essentially what the 14th Amendment, the mandate is conditions for civil and civil detention should not be punitive. And if conditions are similar to or identical to or more restrictive than or similarly restrictive as compared to a punished prisoner population, then you can infer that it's a punishment. And when you go to a place like Orange County Jail, where you have ICE detainees and prisoners side by side in units, some cases one cell over from each other, it's pretty easy to infer that that the civil detainees are being treated like prisoners. How much time do I have? I'm okay. You're out. I'm out. Okay. So last thing I'll say, and then I'll pass it on to my colleagues, is there are some challenges here. There are it's a different population. Immigrants are generally not as savvy about their rights, and they're not as interested about some of these conditions issues because they are rightfully focused on their immigration proceedings and are afraid of putting their name on a lawsuit or in a declaration that could lead to retaliation. So that's a challenge. Second challenge is just the enormity of the system. The system is a giant beast problem, I call it, and people can be moved around. So if you are gonna go look at one facility and contemplate some litigation in one facility or challenging conditions in one facility, well, they can move your clients out to another facility or to another state. Or they can move an entire class of people out. So we have to think about what the end goal is here, and that really is one lesson learned is how important it is to be keyed in with immigration advocates in thinking about how to challenge conditions without doing harm to the people we're trying to make things better. So I'll stop there. Thank you for listening. I'm going to hand it over to Catherine.
Thank you, Aaron, very much. And before we hear from Catherine, I just want to say this. Those of you who have been working in this area, you know it very well. If there is a two-minute drill that can give us background about what laws apply and how they apply, that would be good. I'm familiar with the detaining of people in mental hospitals, and I know that system, but I don't know the immigration system, for example, and many of us don't. Catherine?
Yes, thank you so much. Okay, I am just very grateful to be here today. I think that while this may be a new topic for this conference, it also comes right back to the heart of when the government started excluding people on the basis of their disability, on the basis of eugenics, and on the basis of immigration. And so I'll talk more about how those have been connected since Ellis Island. And when I was initially invited to speak with you this year, the plan was I was going to talk more about my work with children who were detained by the Office of Refugee Resettlement in shelters across the country. I particularly worked in Houston, where one of the worst centers is the Shiloh Residential Treatment Center, which is a center where children are placed if they have a disability, if they act out. Some children did have legitimate psychiatric disabilities. Other children had conditions like blindness, deafness, autism, intellectual disability, fetal alcohol syndrome, trafficking victims who were experiencing trauma. Those children were routinely medicated against their will, against the consent of their parents. Oftentimes they would be given 5 or 6 psychotropic medications, sometimes given metformin so that they would not develop diabetes type 2 as children. Texas no longer places children there because too many have died in custody. But at the same time, the government still continues to do that. So I was there talking to kids, hearing the kids' stories every week for 2 years, every Friday. So Fridays for me are always, I think back to that experience. And I did leave after a while, and I have found myself working with Al Otro Lado, which is an organization in Tijuana that works in Tijuana and in San Diego, and it really focuses on the impediments to asking for legal asylum from asylum seekers. It's very clear under any type of international law or federal law that people have a right to apply for asylum. However, for the past several years, including under the Obama administration, people have been metered, so only a certain number of people are allowed to ask for asylum each day. So it's been traditionally in the past several months about 100 people a day down to 40. And this is at a land crossing, which is the largest in the world, where between Tijuana and San Diego, about 300,000 people cross each day. And only 40 or so people can ask for asylum. So I've been working there as a pro bono coordinator. I've also been working there, especially since the large flow of immigrants since about November. And given the situation, I am so honored to be in the position of pro bono coordinator because we have brought down over 1,300 volunteers, about 400 or 500 attorneys to come down and work and bear witness. So the outpouring of support has been like nothing I've ever seen. So I wanted to just, as an introduction, just go a little bit into the history of Ellis Island. And I'm not sure if you guys have heard of Henry Goddard, who came up with the idea of feeble-minded and morons. Those are the types of terminology used to exclude people with disabilities from wide ranges of life in the United States. What is important to realize is that those terminologies, that was partly due to his academic research on Ellis Island when he was looking at who was feeble-minded who was coming to Ellis Island. And he determined with his researchers that about 40% of Jews, Italians, and Hungarians were in these categories. And so we're, you know, 100 years later, and we're still seeing some of that extreme exclusion. And I wanted to talk about a little bit about Jacobus ten Broek and the right to live in the world, and to emphasize again that it isn't an issue of a person with a disability has all these limitations, but so much of it is that the limitations that are placed on them. And he writes that the actual physical limitations resulting from the disability more often than not play little role in determining whether the physically disabled are allowed to move about and be in public places. Rather, that judgment for the most part results from a variety of considerations related to public attitudes which not infrequently are quite erroneous and misconceived. So that kind of brings us to the Office of Refugee Resettlement and to the situation that children find themselves in. First of all, I think it's important to acknowledge that the Office of Refugee Resettlement has not really thought through what disability means, and does not have screening material, has very, very minimal understanding of what a disability even is. They do a basic screening, which if they identify a child with a disability, then they are subject to having a home study before they can go to their sponsor. That's about the only discussion of disability. So what that means is that children who come to the United States are fleeing violence and are coming in order to be reunified with their parent. If they're identified as having a disability, then they have to go through an extra several month long process, oftentimes, to be released to their parent or to other sponsors. So basically, just being diagnosed as having a disability puts these children into an entirely separate category or in channel, which means that we shouldn't be jailing children, I don't think, but in any case, children with disabilities are jailed longer because of this understanding of disability. And again, one of the things as well is that the Office of Refugee Resettlement has standards that are much heightened for parents and for caretakers who want to take care of children with disabilities. While it's really clear on the part of the Department of Justice, on the Health and Human Services, and of pretty much, you know, any kind of civil rights initiative, that parents should have the right to parent children with disabilities, and that children have the right to be parented by parents with disabilities, that hasn't really gotten through. So we have situations where children are diagnosed with a mental illness, and then it is determined that it's not in their best interest to be with the family because maybe the family can't take care of the child's needs, their mental health needs. And so children end up in long-term prison-like conditions because they have a mental illness. And another area which is very disturbing is the use of psychiatric medications against children's will, and there seems to be no protocol or understanding regarding these processes. This has been subject to litigation and also a lot of the investigation that I had done. So children are very often, when they're sent to this residential treatment facility, they're very often very quickly diagnosed with bipolar disorder, with schizophrenia, and with a few other conditions that allow for the use, usually off-label, of antipsychotic medications. And so one typical child was taking, at the same time, Prozac, Abilify, Clonidine, Risperdal, Seroquel, Zyprexa. This kid is out of prison, and I recently had dinner with her, and she was talking to me about her algebra classes. Very, very great kid and subject to this. They also used as a control mechanism regularly injecting kids with benzodiazepines, and on a weekly basis. Emergency, it's hard to claim emergency when an emergency happens every week. But nevertheless, that's occurring. That happened against the consent of parents, and many of these children are orphans, so they had no protection. Another area that is beyond just the residential treatment center, but is the use of medical and mental health professionals to find out damning information of children and to use that against them. Most of these children know not to trust the police, not to trust parents, not to trust anybody in their lives, given what they've suffered. But they do think that they can talk to a doctor in a white coat. They think they can talk to a social worker. They think they can talk to a psychologist. Then that psychologist writes down notes of everything that has ever happened to the child. And for example, if a child has been threatened by a gang, or if a child has a family member who is a part of a gang, or if a child has witnessed a horrible thing, that gets flagged in their Office of Refugee Resettlement file, and that continues with them. It gets shared with ICE, it gets shared with the Department of Justice. And so children who have had a conversation with the social worker, with a psychologist, trying to explain, you know, when I was 12, I was forced to do weapons training. That becomes a way for them, for that child, not to be released from immigration detention and to likely be sent back to the country that they fled. And one of the challenges is, how do we address this? One of the challenges with the Guantanamo Bay, with torture at Guantanamo Bay, was saying that the psychologist should not be in the role of facilitating torture or facilitating lapses of medical ethics. And so the question now is, what are social workers doing? What are psychologists doing? What are psychiatrists doing if they're in the position of taking information from vulnerable children and using it to harm them? Another huge challenge has been the inability of advocates to really effectively advocate. They oftentimes are funded by the Office of Refugee Resettlement, and so it's sort of like biting the hand that feeds you. It's hard to make claim because they're technically supposed to be representing children in underlying asylum claims, and so it's hard for an attorney to try to press for conditions litigation or conditions complaints when the very existence of the attorney's position is due to the Office of Refugee Resettlement liking to work with you. That really does create a barrier, to say the least, and it does create high turnover, and it creates a lot of systemic issues that I think do decrease the ability of children to effectively be represented. And so I guess, so that's kind of the huge negative that we're dealing with. But a few things that I think are really important, and I really want to focus on what Aaron has said about collaboration with immigrant advocates is so important. We have been able to now have litigation through the general litigation, the Flores settlement, which gives people individual rights for a variety of, for conditions of confinement for children. We now have included in there, Rehabilitation Act claims in there for the first time. And so the judges who are looking into that are looking at Rehabilitation Act claims directly on that, and the immigration community is starting to understand that this is an area that they can work on. Another area that was very important is the disability rights community being involved in the rulemaking process. When some of the, I think the limitations of previous regulations were that nobody from a disability rights perspective was in the room. And now there have been a series of rulemaking actions where the disability rights community has been exceptionally active and has really, really brought their voice to bear at the very beginning. So I think that that's a huge development and something that everybody, many people in this room, should be very proud of. And then another area is just the broadening of community and of saying this isn't just something for lawyers, but that this is something for every neighbor. The child who I had dinner with and who was talking about algebra, the reason she was out was because one of my volunteers' best friends from college said she was going to open up her home to this child she had never met. And so she, step by step by step, fought with the Office of Refugee Resettlement so that this child could be released. And so this was a case of a person who doesn't have much interest in legal issues, who was able to be transformative in this family's life. And so I think that's a really good lesson from there. And then another thing as well, that Aaron already talked about this, but sometimes it's very difficult to get access to organizations and access to shelters. And so the way that the Disability Rights Bar Association and the NDRN have been able to go in and observe and monitor has been absolutely transformational. And that's just a huge thing to one bright spot in this situation. And then I wanted to go into, I'll be less time on this, but the Al Otro Lado, which is an organization in Tijuana and San Diego, where we work on people who want to ask for asylum. And they've been turned away with the issue of being told, you know, we don't have capacity for asylum seekers. And so that's created a situation where people are stuck in Mexico. And in response to that, we have been, and I guess one thing that's important about people coming from different perspectives is that the origin of this project that I'm on now is a criminal defense attorney, Nicole Ramos, found out that people were being turned away from the port of entry. And nobody had even thought that people should ask for asylum at the port of entry. Nobody for many years had even looked at the law to see what it required. And Nicole just looked at what the law said. And so she, for several years, has been accompanying asylum seekers from around the world to the port of entry to say, the law says I have a right to apply for asylum. Now this has gotten worse with a variety of issues of now it being almost entirely closed off, and there's a lot of media coverage around there. One part that hasn't made the media coverage is that in light of these abuses, we've had over 1,300 people come to volunteer. We've set up in just a few weeks, we have set up individual credible fear interview screenings, asylum screenings, so that every single person who wants to learn about the asylum process can come to our office and have a meeting with a qualified legal worker who is supervised by an expert immigration attorney to learn about their rights and to learn about how to protect themselves. Another thing we've instituted is a rights-based approach to what to people who have vulnerabilities. We're not looking at it as this person is weak or this person needs special help. We're looking at it as this person, because of their characteristics, is more likely to be subject to discrimination. So we are identifying and flagging unaccompanied minors. We are flagging people who speak indigenous language as their first language. We are identifying people who are at immediate risk of harm in Mexico. We also are identifying people who have disabilities because we know of what may occur to them in immigration detention. And so we're training all of our volunteers who come down every single day to learn about how to work with people with disabilities. And to say, this is an issue of not of a you need special help, but more about here's how you can defend your rights, and here are what your rights are as a person with a disability. One area that we've done as well is looking at the issue of medical care and medical neglect, and figuring out how we can create documentation for people when they cross over and ask for asylum, so that we get doctor's notes to kind of show this person has a serious medical need. Customs and Border Patrol, you're on notice for this. Here's what happens if you don't do it, and here's the likely harm, so that we have a written record for the person before they enter, so that we can tell ICE and CBP, you have complete notice of this. We're still fighting this, and it doesn't always get people the care that they need, but it does allow for disability to be starting to be litigated front and center. And I think that the to just be wrapping up, the biggest thing that we can ask for right now is it is so important for people to come to the border and for people to come to the detention centers all around you and the immigration courts all around you. We've experienced a lot of retaliation because of our work, because we're suing the federal government, and including having our directors all be denied access to Mexico. One director, Nora Phillips, who has a connective tissue disability, was denied entry in Mexico for over 9 hours without water in retaliation for her work. And so the way that we can fight that is to come to Tijuana and to be reading Aaron's report and to be going to our detention centers right where we live. Thank you.
Thank you. So Mark Weber.
Thanks very much to Dr. Moore, and thanks to everyone here for the chance to address you. I'm really honored. What I want to try to talk about today is the disability rights issues in connection with the proposed regulations having to do with public charges that relate to immigration. And the basics here are not only to talk a little bit about what these regulations are proposing to do and what their impact will be, but to give you a little bit of context to how it is they've come about, where it is they fit in. Part of this is that traditionally, there has been, at least since the 1880s and probably a little bit before that, some exclusion of various categories of potential immigrants to the United States, to the point where by 1990, there were actually 33 categories in the immigration law, including what was then called mental retardation, but also people who were, quote, insane, people who had physical defects, disease, or disability. HIV was not actually removed as a category until 2010. There is a real connection here to the eugenics movement. Obviously, that hadn't started in the 1880s much, but it was certainly in full swing during the height of the immigration period in the early 20th century. And as Catherine mentioned, there was this whole science of trying to show that one or another ethnicity had a higher connection to disability, had a higher connection to inability to care for oneself, had a connection to things that are going to pollute the native stock and in other ways harm the United States. And it took so long to get rid of any of that stuff. As I said, it was 1990 before we actually got rid of all of these various categories, and it didn't really end until 2010. The one thing, though, is that the public charge exclusion was never modified during that period in any serious way. And what the public charge exclusion does is excludes from entry those individuals who are, quote, likely to become a public charge. And that then has, of course, wound up being used in a way that the 33 categories were used before to exclude people from entry to the United States. A couple of things that should be maybe mentioned about that have to do with what the proposed regulations are. The current law, which I've not really tried to produce in a slide here, but the current law does in general provide for the exclusion of people who are likely to become a public charge. Does not apply to asylees or refugees, but does apply to pretty much every other category. For very short temporary visits, it's not applied in any serious way, but it is applied to students, it is applied to people coming in as parolees, people coming in on an immigration basis to become or to be spouses of people who have other kinds of immigration status. There are dozens of immigration categories, and it's applicable to all of those. It can be applied specifically at the point of consular admission, where overseas or in Mexico or elsewhere that's contiguous to the United States, you try to get an immigrant visa or a visa in one of these other categories, and you're required to get a medical certificate. In theory, you can appeal the inability to get the certification that you won't be a public charge. Practically speaking, people generally seem to give up. historically recently, people who have gotten sponsors have not had too much trouble getting their counselor denials undone. That may change because the proposed regulations have language making sponsorship less determinative than it once seemed to have been. Other things that maybe should be mentioned, the rules currently deriving from proposed regulations that were never finalized in 1999 and a field manual that was adopted in 1999 provide that what public charge means is somebody who gets more than half their support in cash assistance from the government or people who are subject to long-term institutionalization. Many of us were extremely critical of that. And now in a way to prove that however bad you think things are, they can also get worse. The current proposed regulation is, and this is what is on the slide, replacing the standard of primarily dependent on cash benefits or institutionalized care with that of receipt of monetizable benefits, so cash benefits, equaling 15% of the federal poverty guidelines for a household of one. That's basically, yeah, if you figure that out, that's about $152 a month. So it's hardly what I would think of as public support. Or non-monetizable benefits, SNAP, that is food stamps, or Medicaid, or whatever is the state equivalent of those various things that might be for 12 of the last 36 months, or if you get both, 9 of the last 36 months. Now, and there is a bit of a caveat here. Many people who are trying to get their status adjusted or to enter at counselor offices have been excluded from a lot of public benefits since 1996 anyhow. So it's really quite unclear precisely how many people are going to be affected. But at least in recent years, many states have allowed various equivalents, sometimes with modest federal support, for these programs, even though the immigrants are excluded otherwise under the laws that were passed under the Newt Gingrich Congress in the 1990s. So it could be a large fraction of people who are ultimately going to be excluded. The regulations actually even propose that Medicare Part D drug subsidies are going to count. They're unclear whether they're going to include the CHIP program. So it's really quite drastic, quite draconian. What's more, if you are trying to get your immigrant status continued or you're trying to get adjusted to lawful permanent resident in the U.S., if you make less than 125% of the federal poverty guideline, that's a heavily weighted negative factor to get that adjustment of status. And it doesn't become a positive factor until you've got 250% of the federal poverty guideline or what we really prefer, they say, is 400% of the federal poverty guideline. It might be noted, and probably all of you do know this, of course, people with disabilities have roughly 3 times the rate of poverty of the rest of the American population. So a whole lot of people with disabilities who are immigrants are going to be caught by this. I did put the URL for the proposed regulations at the bottom of this slide. So if you go onto the web and get to the website for the conference, you can just click on that under the presentation that I've got, and you'll find the actual regulations themselves. Comments closed back in December, but they're still under consideration. I did want to mention, and this is what I've kind of suggested before, that vast numbers of immigrants are likely to be disqualified from entry. And what's more, and this was emphasized particularly strongly in the program that we just came from the breakout in, people are really being discouraged from even applying for benefits that they might be entitled to because they're simply afraid that ultimately they or another member of the household will never be able to adjust their status and will ultimately be subject to deportation. There actually is a ground of deportation on the basis of public charge, rarely been used recently, but given the current politics, I'm not at all comfortable that that will continue to be the case. I did want to mention a few numbers because, as I said, nobody knows exactly what the numbers are, but thanks to the fact that Henry J. Kaiser made a whole lot of money many years ago and founded the Kaiser Family Foundation, they tried to put some numbers into play here. They said that 550,000 individuals living within the U.S. obtained lawful permanent residence status in 2017. About 380,000 of those did so through a pathway that now will be subject to a public charge determination. 94% of non-citizens who originally enter the U.S. without this lawful permanent residence status have at least one characteristic DHS would weigh negatively in a public charge determination. 42% heavily weighted negative factors. Over 34% have incomes below that 125% threshold. They estimate that if the proposed rule led to Medicaid disenrollment rates of 15 to 35% among Medicaid and CHIP enrollees, between 2.1 and 5 million Medicaid CHIP enrollees would disenroll, which is a tremendous blow not only to those individuals, but obviously to public health, just as a general thing for everyone. Let me mention what I think of as kind of salient bases on which people might object to the proposed rules. And the first one, perhaps the most obvious to all of us, is the idea that it discriminates against people with disabilities. And it really, really does. Not only is it true that these various factors, such as income or really the whole idea of the things related to becoming a public charge, may correlate with disability, but also disability is listed as a factor that the government is supposed to consider in determining whether someone is likely to become a public charge. It isn't even saying, well, it's a consideration whose impact may, it's disability is a factor. And it's a heavily negatively weighted factor, essentially, because of the way that the totality of circumstances test that they're proposing is to be applied. What's more, the second thing that might be emphasized as well, we have had the existing regulation, which, bad as it might be, certainly is a lot more helpful. It's existed since 1999. Has Congress done anything to change it? No. When it was adopted, they said that it was consistent with dictionary definitions and with traditional practice of what was then the INS, and nobody challenged any of that. Oddly enough, the proposed regulations say, well, looking at dictionary definitions and looking at what we think is historical practice, this modest level of public support, of course, means you're a public charge. Anybody who gets free or subsidized medical care is a public charge, making essentially the entire population of Western Europe into a public charge. So it seems rather strange, if nothing else. It appears to conflict with the 1996 welfare reform, which led to some categories of immigrants being able to get these kinds of welfare programs. It seems totally irrelevant or irrational in many respects. The 15% of the FPG was totally picked out of a hat, as far as I can tell, as well as the 125% category. Many of us submitted comments to the regulations. I think the comments from the ACLU are terrific, the New York City Bar comments, the National Disability Rights Network submitted a great comment, so did the DREDF and a number of other organizations. For what it's worth, the one that I submitted with Jessica Roberts and with a couple of other folks who are disability law practitioners in Chicago is at the URL that's listed at the bottom there. I have to say my favorite comment was a five-word one that simply says, "Don't do it, you monsters." So then the question, we're a legal conference here. Are there any possible legal strategies here? I mean, one of which is, attack it on the basis of being arbitrary and capricious, contrary to the Administrative Procedure Act. Try to list the ways in which it appears to be inconsistent with current applications of the Immigration and Nationality Act, possibly the ACA, because they're penalizing people who the ACA is trying to get onto Medicare, for heaven's sake, the 138% of poverty level population. The second thing that I wanted to mention that might be a strategy to challenge it, Remember the Hobby Lobby case? You know, many of us were not terribly fond of that when that came down, but it essentially said that the regulations that the Obama administration adopted requiring contraceptive coverage were contrary to not the First Amendment. They didn't say the First Amendment. They said that they're contrary to the Religious Freedom Restoration Act. So does that maybe suggest to you that the regulations here in an unrelated area might be contrary to Section 504, which does bind the federal government? Now, 504's wording with respect to the federal government is rather convoluted and maybe not all that helpful, but I think it might be a strategy, and it's one that maybe gives you a litigation hook, because as has been mentioned before, it's really hard to find a private right of action anywhere, but there is one under Section 504, so that might be yet a strategy that might be able to be adopted. Will litigation work? Heaven only knows. I'm not terribly optimistic about the strategy of simply submitting regulation comments. There are 266,000 that have been filed already. If nothing else, the mere fact of trying to wade through them might slow the government down. But I'm not terribly helpful or terribly hopeful that we're going to actually get results from that process. So any ideas that anybody has along these lines, I think, would be extraordinarily welcome. And there does appear to be a somewhat unconnected, but at least a strongly felt coalition, maybe semi-coalition, demi-coalition, that maybe could be formed with respect to trying to oppose what the government is doing here. Thank you.
Thank you, Mark. And thank you, Mark, very much. I appreciate all of your comments. Catherine was saying that the term feeble-minded came out of the eugenics movement. And there are two others that came out of the same movement. One of them was imbeciles, and the other was idiots. And there's a hierarchy. I've forgotten the hierarchy now, but some are more mentally incapable than others, apparently, and all of these came out. It shows you something if you recall that these tests were given to the recruits who went into World War I, and about 40% of the recruits who joined up at that time, if memory serves, were determined to be feeble-minded. It tells you either how valuable the test was or something about soldiering, I don't know which. Are there questions for these panelists? Identify yourself if you would.
I want to get clarity on the rule. Is that going to apply to people that are like family-based immigrants? And if it's family-based immigrants, they're required to have a sponsor, and their sponsors are required to have a lot of money to be able to sponsor them, or they have to get backup sponsors. So, I mean, is that one of the cases they're looking at, is immigration?
The answer is yes, yes, and yes. So, yes, it will.
Get on the mic here.
Oh, am I off? Oh, okay. The answer is yes, yes, and yes. It does apply to people coming in as spouses or as family members. It's true that traditionally sponsorship had been a heavily weighted factor and had meant that often you could get the visa. The comments that are attached to the regulations are quite disparaging of sponsorship. And so I'm skeptical that sponsorship will be treated the way that it has been before. At the moment, in recent years, the government had rarely gone after the sponsors when the individual needed public assistance, but I don't know whether that's going to continue to be the case either.
No, what I mean, if it's just to get the visa,
right,
they're going to have.
But you're talking about
them just having problems to get the visa.
Yes.
In other words, a sponsor comes in, but someone has some condition that might need some help that they would deny the immigration visa?
It appears that is permissible, and from the comments and the regulations, it strikes me that that is more likely to happen.
Thank you.
Other questions? And your name is?
Sorry, I'm Anna Levine, TRE Legal Practice. Are you concerned if you, in litigation about, given the Muslim travel ban case, about deference to, in sort of what's considered evidence of discrimination, or want to challenge this in court?
Thanks for the question. Yes, not only is there Trump against Hawaii, which I had to just reread again for my federal courts class, but also cases going back a ways, Matthew against Diaz, others that have this very strong deference to the federal government. You know, there had been earlier cases indicating that states can't discriminate against immigrants, even possibly immigrants who aren't here lawfully, at least in another in a number of circumstances. But there's this very great deference to the feds with regard to immigration. Now, it's true, Trump against Hawaii did emphasize national security, which doesn't seem to be a relevant consideration here. But again, this will be an uphill fight if you're going to challenge it on litigation, which is probably why it would matter a lot to have a workable coalition.
Other questions? And your name?
Eric Rosenthal with Disability Rights International.
Go ahead.
I was part of the panel that spoke earlier on immigration and asylum, and appreciate the fact that this conference has given so much focus on this issue. Some of the issues that I mentioned at that I was unable to actually follow up on. I mean, we're an organization, Disability Rights International, that documents the abuses that people would face in other countries if they are deported. So we are deeply appreciative of the efforts of immigration and asylum attorneys who are working in the United States to help people to prevent that deportation, because they truly do face incredible, incredible abuses if they are returned and they face the prospect of being placed in psychiatric hospitals, orphanages, or other facilities in other parts of the world. Part of the discussion that I didn't mention earlier in the previous panel, we've heard a lot about the separation of parents and children at the U.S. border. My organization has documented an issue, which I just want to alert you to, which is that children separated from their families at the border, as well as unaccompanied minors who are returned to Mexico, are often not reunified with their families. These are children who are just dumped back into an abusive social care system in Mexico. Mexico has a large orphanage system, so a lot of these kids are going to be dumped into institutions, even if they have parents, when they are returned to Mexico. We're going to be publishing a report on the situation at the end of April. So keep an eye out for it, Disability Rights International, looking at the impact of the people sent back to Mexico.
Comments from panelists?
I think we're just so grateful that there is that international that focus. Our organization also is working with parents who are returning to the United States who were separated from their children, and some of their children are experiencing extreme trauma, PTSD, and some of them are in the position of perhaps being adopted by foster parents, by other people, because of that family separation. And if you think about the level of additional trauma that's going to occur, especially with children who are deaf or with many other disabilities. So it's important to recognize the whole context of this.
Other questions?
Yes.
Tell me your name.
Victor Panoff from the Florida PNA.
Yes, sir.
With regards to the public charge rule, is there any time frame, outer limit time frame? Let's say you have an LPR who's here for 12 years and starts receiving some sort of public assistance. You said that there's a little used ground for deportation, but what about if someone wants to adjust for naturalization?
Yeah, so naturalization is not clearly spelled out with regard to how that works under the rules. The greater concern that I saw advocates expressing with regard to people who have LPR status, that's lawful permanent resident status, is that the government appears to be contemplating that if the person who has LPR status is away from the U.S. for more than 6 months, that then the public charge exclusion will be applied to that person if that person tries to reenter. But the regulations are actually rather ambiguous about that. the proposed regulations. So it's quite uncertain. But generally speaking, you're right. If there's a application for extension of a visa or extension of a non-LPR status, then the public charge exclusion does come into play.
I appreciate the comments of the panelists. It does seem to me that the people who get their courage together and put their energy into immigration into the United States demonstrate that they have something to contribute, and I keep wondering why we don't welcome them. Consequently, my point of view on immigration might be different than some I've heard about. I am thankful for you to come. I know that my own grandparents a long time ago were immigrants, and I am glad to be amongst so many other immigrants here. We are now ready for the break, and there'll be a little coffee. And furthermore, we have workshops after that, and we come back here at 4:15. Thank you very much to the panel members.